businesses have a responsibility throughout their entire value chains to respect human rights. If you can apply pressure at the top of the supply chain strategically, then you can achieve change at the bottom.
You are listening to Radio Atticus,
your national program on the law in the name of social justice.
This is obviously a live issue, and we need to start to talk about how we might regulate it here that we aren't outsourcing our problems.
People are curious. They look at you and they want to know your story.
Radio Atticus, more than the vibe.
Hello and welcome to your national program on the law and justice and how it impacts your daily lives. Anna Marie Reyes.
Hi, I'm Sophia Carvajal. I'm joining Anna Marie on your favourite legal broadcast.
In this edition, we look into Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull's announcement on increased joint exercises between the police and military personnel with changes to the Defence Act. But first, continuing our look into lawyers and justices and why they're talking about killing all the lawyers. When lawyers and justices met at an Australasian law teachers' conference in South Australia, there was much concern about big changes taking place in the legal sector. Here's the excerpt of Series 1, which explains their concerns. Democracy is under threat, justices are judged in the media, legal jobs are disappearing while student numbers are on the rise, and lawyers are no longer expected to be in courthouses as much as doing problem solving online or settling out of court. The tide of change is so big that after almost a week of deep stock taking, the final panel was called
from Shakespeare's play, Henry VI. Jack Cade was historically a true character, and he led a rebellion, and gradually Cade builds up to an absolute orchestra. Dick says, the first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. So that is the context of it all.
I prefer the interpretation that says Jack Cade was a rabble, wanted to kill all the lawyers because they represented the means by which
Now we open the next series, hearing from the side of lawyers working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australia. Proud Narunga woman Cheryl Axelby has family ties across South Australia. She's also the Chief Executive Officer of the Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement Incorporated. Her career spanned over 35 years working for the Government of South Australia and also the not-for-profit sector. Her achievements are in social justice, cultural inclusion, and working with the Women's Legal Service, among a few. She's also the co-chair of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services. Miss Axelby couldn't make it to the panel killing all the lawyers due to sorry business, especially during NAIDOC season, so the Honourable Robin Layton, AOQC, relayed her message.
If I could just say something briefly about Cheryl. She is currently now at a national Aboriginal leadership level, and she chairs a number of really important Aboriginal organisations. She is the co-chair of Change the Record, which is a very recently formed organisation by Aboriginal people with the focus on reducing incarceration right around all of the places in Australia, and in particular with regard to juvenile detention. She is the Aboriginal spokesperson for an organisation that I chair, which is the Justice Reinvestment South Australia. So she is a well-known and very well-respected Aboriginal leader. So what she has asked me to say on her behalf is this. She first of all wanted to underscore the importance that lawyers have had in the human rights movement and within the legal system for advancing the rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and legal services around Australia. She says that Aboriginal legal services around Australia were established with in-kind support provided by leaders in the legal profession, such as the late Elliot Johnston, for whom we will forever be grateful. Elliot also played a key role in the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody and he made many recommendations, most of which still remain unimplemented by government.
You're listening to Radio Atticus' series on a panel titled Let's Kill All the Lawyers during the Australasian Law Teachers Conference recently in South Australia. This story looks at the perspective of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leader Cheryl Axelby. She takes the position that lawyers are still seriously needed in her community. Honourable AOQC Robin Layton continues with Ms. Axelby's message to the conference.
Lawyers are still very important today for many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples facing the justice system. But the good old human rights focus has dwindled when representing our peoples. The legal professions must look always to human rights principles as well as the recommendations from the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody when representing us. As we in South Australia are faced with current changes to legislation which are rebadged as much-needed law reform, rather than the reality that these reforms are eroding the right to proper justice through political interference. And this is a great concern for the ALRM and about the South Australian legal system in general. We will be the second state, and she says Victoria is the other, where the defence can be required to disclose certain aspects of their defence ahead of any trial, rather than the prosecution having the obligation at all times to prove the case against the defendant beyond reasonable doubt. She also says that there is a further issue, and that is the dangling of carrots to enter pleas to get remissions in sentence. And this is a cause for concern, as many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and also other vulnerable peoples in South Australia can be pressured to plead guilty when they are in a situation where they have been on remand for a long period of time after their arrest and before they are able to have their case dealt with, and so they get more and more pressured as a result of that circumstance to instead plead guilty rather than plead not guilty and have a further period of remand while their trial is dealt with. So she says that this is leading to even higher incarceration and overcrowding in a system that's already in crisis. She says, in closing, I say, let's not kill all the lawyers, and that had Shakespeare's character lived in current times, he might now have said, let's kill all of the politicians. So that was Cheryl's contribution, and I'm sure she would have extended that with time to some of the current legislation, which is putting security in relation to children, and also the proposed legislation on treating youth as adults for the purposes of sentencing, which I've seen put security ahead of rehabilitation. So that's a debate yet to be had, and I'm hoping that people, in particular academics and researchers, can come out with why that is a backward step.
Another panel member, the Honourable Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of South Australia, Chris Kourakis, focused his perspective on the future trend for lawyers. He starts with looking at innovative ways of introducing access to justice.
In the civil area, there is a massive problem with access to justice that John adverted to. That's not going to be solved by government funding. The demands on government funds for things like health in particular, but other areas of social service, importantly education, are just far too great and will swamp out any attempt to provide any meaningful amount of money for legal aid. At the same time, and perhaps because of that lack of funding, the way in which the law is administered in the civil area is also changing. There have been changes in modes of practice. I walked out of the court onto King William Street a few weeks ago, and there was a car all painted up with signage saying mobile law will come to you and with a mobile phone number on it. Now, I think that's a terrific thing. I think that is probably a young practitioner finding it difficult to get work somewhere else who's come up with a novel idea. That is good. Just before I entered the profession, because of the lack of work, a whole couple of years of graduates went out into the suburbs. They are now Adelaide's, many of them Adelaide's established law firms, and there's no doubt they improve the access to justice. So there's things like that. In the United States, we have this massive online mediation service called Modria, which is replacing to a large extent the need for legal services in low-level consumer disputes. There is a service in the United States where you can post your legal question online, and within 15 minutes you'll have tens if not hundreds of answers to your legal problem from lawyers. But they will answer it briefly, obviously enough, in the hope of then taking in a client. But nonetheless, despite that commercial motive, many people are getting a quick and probably effective answer to a legal query. So methods of delivery of legal practice are certainly changing.
He also pointed out the increased bureaucratic process in the legal sector and the letter of the law is making it inaccessible and expensive to hear court cases.
At the same time, the content of the law is changing. One of the real reasons for the great expense and the difficulty in accessing justice in the civil, on the civil side is the tradition of orality which we have in the courts, giving people a lot of expensive time to give evidence in chief in a long, convoluted way, allowing hours and sometimes days of cross-examination that really goes nowhere, very expensive barristers sitting in court or standing in court for the whole time. And both because of that, I think, but also because of the increasing complexity of social regulation, we're now moving away from social regulation, which involves court hearings, to greater bureaucratisation. And so you have more legislation and regulations and bureaucratic regulation of society through things like consumer codes, environmental codes and the like. That will, and the regulation of public utilities takes a similar form. Compensation is now much more bureaucratically organised, workers' compensation, than it once was. And civil actions in for industrial accidents. So we have this much greater bureaucratisation of the law. Courtrooms too, where matters aren't regulated by bureaucracies, will change. We will do much more online. The judge now will spend much more time in his or her office working on a computer, looking at written submissions and statements and making a decision on the basis of that. They might not always be of the high quality that you get by giving the time to present oral argument, but you will get decisions and people will be able to get on with their lives much more effectively. The way in which courtrooms are designed will change. I imagine on the civil side that they'll look much more like an arbitrator's room does, with an effectively enabled best people sitting around it, actually collaboratively trying to work out the most effective solution. So what then of what we see as the really the core of judicial work now?
Chief Justice Karakas also looked at what could be the challenges posed when addressing human rights.
I suspect there will be more human rights work thrown the way of judges. And there are mixed views about that. I worry about courts becoming involved in contested questions of human rights values. But it's something the United States lives with, as John pointed out. Very interesting position in the United States in the tussle to maintain the majority between conservatives and progressives, as we know, even in Australia, it doesn't turn out that the person you appoint sticks to the values you thought he or she had. But in the United States, until really the 80s and 90s as a result of the turmoil of the 60s and progressive thinking of the 60s that John mentioned. Progressives did take control of that, but we're now seeing a large backlash in that within, and the point that I want to make a little bit of it was that a lot of this came out of the law school, so it was the law schools that produced the progressives that ended up taking the majorities in the Supreme Court. It was equally the law schools of the United States that produced the conservatives who are now close to control, although Anthony Kennedy still seems to be able to make up the majority in the middle. But to come back to my original point, I think that the courts, the traditional world of courts, will remain and perhaps become even more important on the question of fundamental human rights, and associated with that, the fairness in criminal law procedure. And I think, too, that it's a necessary corollary or consequence of the greater regulation of the community through bureaucratic methods, that judicial review will remain an important part of the court's work in its more traditional sense.
And that ends this series of the panel called Let's First Kill All the Lawyers at the recent Australasian Law Teachers Association conference held in South Australia. You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally through the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER. I'm Anna Marie Reyes.
The Loft Bar at UTS on Broadway opens from 2 until late every weekday, making it the perfect spot for an early finish or relaxing after work. With craft beer, seasonal draft specials and cocktails on tap, come and unwind in the Loft's shady courtyard, soundtracked each evening by local acoustic musicians. The Loft Bar at UTS on Broadway is your inner city oasis in the heart of Ultimo. 2SER sponsors.
Well, I'm Gillian Triggs, and for legal news, facts and opinion, listen to Radio Atticus on 2SER.
2SER 107.3.
And this week we're probing the dark recesses of the mind.
Oogum boogum.
Very scary.
Did you wet yourself?
It could happen to you.
Stick around even if that scene does disturb you too much.
You might have seen Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull announcing the proposed changes to the Defence Act with 6 masked Special Forces soldiers recently. The PM says state and territory police will be taught specialised skills by Special Forces soldiers to improve the military's ability to help respond to domestic terrorism incidents. The way military forces interact with police has not been updated since 2005. Joint training exercises with military to respond to terror threats are also proposed. But would this encourage police militarisation, or is this update to the Defence Act a much-needed one, considering the times we live in? Adam Lockyer, Senior Lecturer in Security Studies at Macquarie University, talks to Philip Leeson. But first, here's an excerpt of the press conference with Prime Minister Turnbull.
Very good, thank you. I'm very pleased to be here at Holdsworthy to outline new measures to enhance defence's support to national counter-terrorism arrangements. The measures I'm announcing today will ensure that the ADF is more readily available to respond to terrorism incidents, providing state and territory police with the extra support to call on when they need it. We have to stay ahead of the threat of terrorism. We have to constantly review our law enforcement capabilities. We have to constantly act to improve our ability to keep Australians safe. This is a key focus of my government. There is no place for set and forget or for complacency. Our enemies are agile and innovative. We have to stay ahead of them. My highest priority and that of my government is the safety and security of all Australians, to maintain our way of life, our values and our freedom. Now let me be very clear, state and territory.
Thanks so much for joining me, Adam. Now, under our current defence protocol, what is the military's role in responding to domestic terror threats as opposed to the role of the police force?
Yes, there's a fairly high bar at the moment for calling up the military in response to terrorism. So the legislation currently says that the police force, whether it's New South Wales Police or Federal Police, needs to be completely exhausted in terms of its capability before the ADF can be called in to offer support. So what the new legislation is going to try and do is to lower that bar slightly so that although the police force, whether it's going to be local state police or the AFP, will still be the lead agency in response to terrorist incidents, the ADF will be able to be called out to offer more support in incidents like the recent Lindt Cafe siege.
Mm. Now, in the new changes to the Defence Act, it was proposed that some police units will undertake joint training exercises with the military to understand how they go about responding to terror threats. Could this idea of a crossover between the police and the military potentially create blurred lines between the role of police versus the role of the military in these sorts of situations?
Well, that's one of the concerns about this new legislation. So as long as it remains simply training, there isn't that much concern because most people would agree with the idea that if the state special forces response groups are going to be working hand in hand with the military's like units, then knowing each other's procedures and doctrine is a good idea. Now, if it's only limited to training and getting that crossover in terms of tactics and doctrine, that's one thing. If they're going to start to embed soldiers in police units and police in military units, then that's when the lines start to become very blurred, and that's when things could become a bit more dangerous, and that's where people have concerns.
Well, I understand one of the other concerns or prospective concerns is could police units training with the military be considered a form of police militarisation?
Sure, and so it would be more that the military would be embedding with state police and giving them extra capability. Now, we have seen this joint police-military operation before. In the Solomon Islands, the AFP worked with the military on their patrol. So the AFP would be the ones that would make initial contact with local Solomon Islands citizens, and they would be the interface between the civilians and the security forces. But then you'd have the military right there, ready to be caught up if needed. Now, extending that kind of a model to domestic security could raise a whole bunch of different concerns. It seems to be the model that we're trying to bring across from Britain. After the recent London Bridge attacks, the military was on the streets and patrolling alongside the police in just a few hours after the attack. And so I think that some of this legislation is wrapped up with that kind of an image where you'd see both police and soldiers patrolling jointly on the streets after a terrorist incident.
It's reported that these changes are the first time the Australian Defence Force's contribution to domestic terror threats have been reviewed since 2005. Now, understandably, a lot of people are a little bit wary, but considering how terror threats have changed in nature over the past 12 years, should this review have been initiated earlier? Is it overdue at this point?
Well, yes and no, because the pattern of terrorism since 2005 has been heading the other direction. So we're seeing after September 11, when Al-Qaeda was the principal international organisation trying to commit these terrorist attacks, they were large, they were sophisticated, they took years of planning to before they were implemented. So, and those type of large-scale terrorist attacks, you could probably make a stronger case for the military being caught out in response to those type of attacks. Since then, however, since, say, 2005, we've seen a move more towards those lone wolf attacks, where you have those individuals have been inspired by the goals of Islamic State and others taking it upon themselves to go out and try to commit a terrorist attack. And often these are very low scale in terms of using knives, axes, whatever is available around the house, not much planning, not much coordination with others. And those type of attacks would be far more within the capabilities of the police to respond to than the large-scale attacks that we saw earlier on. So it seems to be the pattern of terrorism is moving the other direction, away from those type of incidents that would more justifiably require a military response.
With that in mind, it does seem interesting timing for this shift then. Now, a lot of people have said that the Sydney siege is a big factor. The PM explicitly stated that the review into the military's contribution to domestic terror threats was not initiated because of the 2014 Sydney siege, but it was initiated through observing patterns of international terrorism. In looking at how other countries delegate responsibility between police and the military responding to terror situations, how does this new proposal compare with other countries?
Yeah, I think that's correct. So I think that we have, whether or not they want to admit this or not, the Lindt Cafe siege looms large in all these decisions. So these two decisions that we've had, first off about changing the call-out powers of the military, and second of all, trying to form a home office. So bringing the AFP, ASIO into one super department is both modelled on the example of the British. And I think that people have been comparing the Lindt Cafe siege response with that of how the British have responded to their recent terrorist incidents in places like the London Bridge attacks. And the British have been compared favourably compared to how the New South Wales police responded. And so a lot of these, both these big announcements about the expansion of the military powers, but also about creating this home office, is about modelling us more on the British model.
Mm. Well, Adam, thanks so much for joining us to explain a little bit about what's going on and to frame this in the global context as well.
That was Philip Leeson talking to Adam Lockyer, Senior Lecturer in Security Studies at Macquarie University, about Prime Minister Turnbull's proposed changes to the Defence Act recently. This interview was produced by Andrew Gibbons.
1917, the Great Strike, marks the centenary of one of Australia's largest industrial conflicts with a six-week-long exhibition at Carriage Works. The multimedia exhibition features large-scale historical images, moving footage, oral history excerpts, and music and poetry alongside commissioned artworks to tell the story of a movement that started in the old Everly Railway workshops. Produced by the City of Sydney and Carriage Works, the free exhibition runs until August 27. For more information, visit whatson.sydney and search for Great Strike.
Sponsors of 2SER.
I'm Michael Kirby, and you are listening to Radio Atticus. Radio Atticus is part of the Community Radio Network. I was formerly a Justice of the High Court of Australia with no time to listen to this, but now I sit glued to Radio Atticus.
You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally through the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER.
So what's happening this week?
Have you ever seen laser beams in the sky?
What were you thinking?
I find an opportunity to lick Richard Wilkins.
Okay.
Interviews and discussions and all sorts of interesting things. 107.3.
2SER.
And that's about all for this week's edition. I hope you enjoyed our stories. If you want more, check out our online podcast on www.2ser.com/Radio Atticus. You'll be able to find our last four programs of Radio Atticus there. A shout out to all our listeners around the country. 2MIA Griffith, New South Wales, 2RRR Gladesville, New South Wales, 2 Wet Tank FM West Kempsey, New South Wales, 2XX FM Canberra City, 3CR Fitzroy, Victoria, 3UJ FM Alexandra, Victoria, 4NSA Queensland in Noosa Heads, 7RPH Hobart, Tasmania, 8CCC Alice Springs, 8Ear Gov FM in Nullanbee, ACT, 3CH in Wooden, Victoria. The content you hear on Radio Atticus is not legal advice. If you need legal advice, please contact your independent legal advisor.
And that's about all we have time for in this edition. We hope you enjoy the show.
Radio Atticus is broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER.
If you want more, why not tune into our podcast on www.2ser.com/Radio Atticus.
Tune in again next week at the same time and place for your regular dose of justice and the law here.